Now we we're looking at the Counter-Reformation, and I hate to run through that in a hurry, but our time is short. We only have 2 hours or 2 years for the course. That's all that I feel we should have in a three-year course, because exegesis is so much more important, to know what God has said than to know what man has done. Nevertheless, to know what man has done has its own real importance. It is important for the lessons we get as to what man's apt to do today, because human nature remains the same. And it is important for us to know the background of present situation. And what we've just been talking about, the Counter-Reformation, was of tremendous importance during the 16th century, and also of very great importance from then on until quite recently. Now, of course, the Jesuit order, from what one can see from the outside, is shot through with modernism and riddled with uncertainty. But for 300 years, it was such a tight military organization under such definite control for the accomplishment of the purposes of its leaders, and so extremely effective in doing so, that it is hard to believe that this order will simply disintegrate in a period of 10 or 15 years. Now, of course, the modernism has not infiltrated in the last 10 years. Doubtless, it was getting a foothold during the last 50 years, but it has become very evident in certain areas now. And yet, it having been such a tremendous instrument for the accomplishment of the purpose of its leaders through all these centuries, it is pretty hard to believe that it just disintegrates in this brief time. It may. On the other hand, the forces which were so effective within it for all these centuries may show themselves and gain possession of it and become tremendous factors within the next 10 or 15 years. We cannot predict. But we should be well aware of what its nature is, of what it has accomplished in the past. Now, somebody asked me a question after class, which was a very intelligent question, but one which perhaps showed that I had not made quite clear enough the complicated nature of all these events. That question was, why did not the Jesuits or the Counter-Reformation conquer North Germany as well as South Germany? And of course, the answer to that is that their conquest of no area was automatic. It was a tough struggle. A tough struggle for one reason, because the Reformation had a head start. If the Jesuit order had been founded 100 years earlier than it was, it is highly probable, humanly speaking, that the Reformation would have died before it got underway. But the Jesuit order did not receive its first tentative approval from the Pope until 1540. And 1517 is when Luther fastened the theses on the door of the church. And so there was 23 years of extension of the Reformation, active extension and very effective extension, before the Pope gave approval for the establishment of an order which would be limited to 60 people. And so you see, it wasn't, as some people call the establishment of the Jesuit order, 1550 instead of 1540. And the reason they do that is because it was in 1550 that a Pope issued an order which gave them the right to become far larger and greatly extended the authority, the power that they had. But 1550 is 4 years after Luther's death, and all the great activity of Luther's life lay before them. And by 1550, situation, the emperor had his interim active in Germany, but the interims were being laughed at and scoffed and ridiculed by the mass of the people, even though they didn't dare oppose them by military force, but some of them were quietly seeking an arrangement with France whereby they could have a little outside help enough to enable them to try to put an end to this effort of the emperor. And so before the Jesuits got well underway, Protestantism had triumphed in Germany to this extent that within 2 years after that, in 1552, the emperor signed the temporary peace, which gave each local duke or count or king or whatever he was with authority over an area the power to determine the religion within that area, provided it was either Roman Catholicism or the teachings which were connected with Luther. And this was made into permanent law by the Peace of Augsburg in 1555. And so you see, the Jesuits were hardly underway before this law was enacted. And by that time, the rulers of just about every section of North Germany, the northern half of Germany, perhaps almost two-thirds of Germany, the rulers were men who were strongly attached to the Protestant Reformation. Luther, who had been about in the middle of that era, his teachings, his books had infiltrated that whole area, so the great mass of the people in that area were solidly devoted to the Reformation. Now, the southern third of Germany was much further away from Luther's center, and had leaders who had been rather against the Reformation, but despite the activity of the leaders, the teachings of the Reformation had infiltrated those regions. And had infiltrated all of what we now know as Austria, which is really just a part of Germany that was separated off from Germany by Bismarck in 1864. But this section, Austria, it's a German word meaning the Eastern realm. This section was nominally under direct control of the emperor. And I mentioned to you how one of the papal legates wrote the pope that the emperor and himself were the only people who followed the pope in Vienna. At one time. Now that was a bit exaggerated. But the fact is that the people had been infiltrated with Protestant teachings and were largely devoted to them right in this area, which was directly under the control of the emperor, not as emperor, but as Duke of Austria. And the north of that, the southern section of Germany, was under the Habsburgs, Wittelsbach, the section called Bavaria. And the Preserved Smith says of the Wittelsbach family that it is about the only German ruling family that did not at some time consider joining the Reformation. Now that's a strong statement, but the truth of it is shown by the fact that when Charles V resigned the emperor as emperor, his brother Frederick Ferdinand took over, but that Ferdinand's son Maximilian, who succeeded him as an emperor, himself at one time was very, very close to becoming a Protestant. And if the Jesuits found out about this, and they sent some very able men, men with a high education, a great knowledge, and very skilled in presenting things, to talk to the young Archduke and to convince him that he was wrong in moving in a Protestant direction. So that by the time he became emperor, he was devoted to the Roman Church, but not strongly devoted. But then they were able to train his children, so they were very strongly devoted. So that in the section where Lutheranism got a good big start, the Jesuits were not able to destroy it. But in sections where the overwhelming majority of the people were in favor of, the Jesuits succeeded. If the ruler gave them freedom there, they succeeded in accomplishing a great deal. And of course, another thing to remember is that the Jesuits had a hard time getting started. Their opposition when they started didn't come simply from Protestants. When the Jesuits began and tried to go into Spain, they were forbidden. They were forbidden to go into Portugal. They got into France, but the leaders of the Roman Church in France put great obstacles in their way. All these organizations were established. They were the representatives of the old church. This was a new upstart order with different ideas. They were opposed to it. The Jesuits had to fight hard and work hard and scheme hard to get an entrance into the various Romanist countries and to get recognition from the leaders of those countries. They succeeded in doing so. Eventually, they became the strongest power in the religious field in all of these countries. But it was a long, tough struggle, and a lot of energy had to go into that could have gone into fighting Protestantism. So that all these facts account for or explain why what the Jesuits won, they had to fight for. They had to work hard for. But they worked very hard. And they were very skillful. They were highly trained. Every one of them had at least 15 years of thorough training after he joined the Jesuit order. And they were trained in how to deal with people, how to speak nicely, how to act pleasantly in polite society, how to make people like them. They never went out as inquisitors treating people in what was evidently a mean way. They would make complaints behind the scenes about the Dominicans or the Franciscans or others if they didn't bring the force and use the persecuting efforts against the people. But they themselves always tried to give a very pleasant impression. And you will find today in just about any field of scientific thought or a scholarly endeavor in the world, you will find that when scholarly papers are given and discussions are held, you will find one or two Jesuits there in the group who are recognized for their ability and for their training, and who, as far as anybody in the group can see, are simply people who are interested in this area of science and doing a good piece of work in it. There's a sort of a summary that Preserved Smith has that I think is very interesting. He says, everyone has noticed the immense versatility of the Jesuits and their superficiality. They produce excellent scholars of a certain rank, men who could decipher Latin inscriptions, observe the planets, publish libraries of historical sources, of casuistry and apologetics, or write catechisms or epigrams. They turned with equal facility to preaching to naked savages and to the production of art for the most cultivated peoples of the world. And yet they have rarely, if ever, produced a great scholar, a great scientist, a great thinker, or even a great ascetic. They were not founded for such purposes. They were founded to fight for the church. And they did that with extraordinary success. Now, I don't know whether we've said enough in this course to make clear what's meant, even a great ascetic. Some of the great saints of the Roman Church are people who have felt that they would glorify God by cutting themselves off from every bit of worldly pleasure. You take even St. Francis, the founder of the Franciscan Order, who came from a wealthy wealthy family from Assisi in Italy. And when he left his father, turned away from his background, he gave up all his clothes, every bit of money he had. He simply went about dressed like a beggar. And he felt, as many of the saints of the Roman Church have felt, that the less they enjoyed things of this life of any kind, the longer they would fast, the more they would scourge themselves, the more they would try to subdue the flesh and to destroy their interest in everything human, the nearer they got to heaven. This we find in Buddhism as well as in Romans. And of course, in some ways, it is far to be preferred from the attitude of some people who, claiming to be Christians, yet find their greatest joy in the pleasures of this life. And Christianity seems like sort of a veneer. But I don't think the Lord wants us to go to either extreme. We don't win the Lord's favor we do win the Lord's favor by subduing the power of flesh over us, by subduing the power of our own craving for certain foods or certain pleasures of any kind to be a major fact in our life. But we don't win the Lord's favor by simply getting away from everything of the good things that the Lord has put in life for the enjoyment of his people. But this is a common idea in many religions. It's very common in Buddhism. And in Romanism, some of the greatest saints, that is, those the most revered, are revered for this sort of thing. Now, this was very far from the thought of the Jesuits. The Jesuits wanted to bring their whole body, their whole mind, their whole thought into complete subjection to the order so that they would be instruments for the accomplishment of its purpose. And, of course, one way they would do that was by making a good impression on others. When I was in Palestine, one of my colleagues at the time and I were in Palestine. We wanted to explore some archaeological sites. We wanted to rent a car and go up there. It was a little more than we wanted to pay for ourselves. We looked around for someone else who would join with us. We found a young Jesuit there, PhD from Johns Hopkins, who was interested in going with us.
And the three of us explored various sites, and he was the finest company you could imagine. He had little German songs to sing to us that were full of interesting humor and interesting little stories to tell, and on the various matters that we looked into, he had a good background of knowledge. He was an excellent companion. And when I heard 2 years later that excavating over in Iraq, he had been on his way back from the excavation, the car he was in had been struck by another and he'd been killed, I felt very sad about him. He really made a fine personal impression on me. But one doesn't know the background. With the training they have, one doesn't know what really is in the mind of these men. And for 400 years, they were a tremendous influence. They may be again in the next century, but just at present, the order is shot through with division and dissension. Well, the Jesuits we did not discuss before discussing Calvin and Luther, because all of Luther's work was done before they became a fact. And a great part of Luther's work was, all of Luther's work done before they became a fact. A great part of Calvin's work was done before they became much of a fact. They were not able to get into Geneva in that century to accomplish anything, because Calvin had built too solidly there. But I left the English Reformation until after we discussed them, because I'd like to deal with it in a consecutive way, and in the latter part of it, they do become a factor of considerable importance. And so we will now go on from the Counter-Reformation, which was Roman numeral 4, to begin Roman numeral 5, which we will call Great Britain in the 16th century. I think I'll change that title. I will say the victory of Protestantism in Great Britain in the 16th century. The victory of Protestantism in Great Britain in the 16th century. Now, I am changing the title for this reason, that there are certain things that happened in the latter part of the 16th century in Great Britain that were very important for a different reason. And I'm going to put them under the next head, because they're so important in relation to what happened in the 17th century, but not very important in their immediate situation. But now I want to take Great Britain right through this 16th century now and to see what happened there. And as we take this up, I want to make Roman numeral A be the importance of this subject, the importance of this subject. How could anything be more important than the study of Luther, that great leader whom God used so tremendously? How could anything be more important than the study of Calvin, whose influence has been and still is so very great, and of the many different areas in which he did such tremendously important work? How could anything be more important than the Counter-Reformation, which has had such a tremendous effect on the lives of millions of people from that time up until, at least till recently, perhaps until the very present? Well, there are some special reasons why the study of the church history of Great Britain in the 16th century is of importance, and I'm going to look briefly at some of these. Number one of these, the one that appears most obviously perhaps, is relation to ourselves. Relation to ourselves. Whatever our racial background, whatever country we come from, the fact is that we are now using the English language. And we are living in a country in which the English language has been used for a long time. And therefore, the interrelations between Great Britain and this country are in a way more close than that with any other country. In addition to that, the people who laid the foundations of life in this country came from Great Britain. And they were greatly affected by developments in Great Britain. And therefore, there's a special reason why we would be interested in the history of Christianity in Great Britain in the 16th century. But number two, its eventual great influence. Its eventual great influence. What happened in France was tremendously important, but eventually the Jesuits succeeded in bringing Christianity almost to a complete end in France. In Poland, they had a third of the country, including most of the nobles, were Protestant. But there the Jesuits succeeded in almost completely rooting Christianity out of, or at least Protestantism, out of Poland. The Great Britain has, and the English-speaking world, has extended an influence over the world in various ways, sufficient to make its influence at least as great as that of any other country in the religious sphere. And so it is quite important we know something about the background of why the religious situation in Great Britain became different from that of any other country. Now, the reason why it was different from that of any other country come mostly in the beginning of the 17th century, though they have their roots in the latter part of the 16th. But an integral part of that is how it came that it is a Protestant area, that it has been for these centuries. Number three, wonderful illustrations of God's providence. We saw some of these in connection with Luther particularly. Wonderful illustrations of God's providence. But in Great Britain, humanly speaking, the whole religious situation of the world would be very different, humanly speaking, if it were not for political and social events which occurred, many of which could not have been predicted in any merely human way, many of which would seem to be purely accidental from a human viewpoint, but which had a tremendous effect on situations. And then a fourth reason is the nature of the Church of England. The Church of England has its representatives or its offshoots in many sections of the world. And it is a different church from any other that there is. It is very different. It has many qualities or attitudes that are very different from any other church. And these are based upon political or historical backgrounds which caused certain things to happen. And while we won't have time to spend a great deal on these, we should know a little bit about how they did come to happen. And so we go on then to capital B, which naturally would be beginnings. Beginnings of the English Reformation. Now, the beginnings of the English Reformation, then, we will run over hastily something of the background, some of which was looked at last year, and some of which is involved in assignment J. Now, the assignments I've given you, assignment H, is which I've given to two-thirds of the class this time, is very interesting in connection with these great French men who God wonderfully used, and then there was some about Switzerland, which was interesting and important and valuable. But assignment J, which only a third of the class has this time, has considerable material about certain very wonderful English Christians, whom I wish I could spend a month on in class, but I will not be able to do much more than mention. And so I would like you particularly to get in mind the main facts about these great Christians of the early Reformation in England, who are described in these particular isolated chapters that I picked out from the fifth volume of D'Aubigné. But number one, certainly to be mentioned in connection with the English Reformation, is John Wycliffe. His name is spelled many ways. I'm here spelling it W-Y-C-L-I-F. Those were the days before typewriters. Nowadays, anybody hires a typist, and even if he can't spell, he expects his typist to be able. And therefore, spelling remains standard. But in the days before typewriters, everybody spelled as they felt inclined to. And consequently, there are many ways of spelling from those days. And sometimes I wish the typewriter hadn't been invented, because our language, our spelling would have developed in a sensible way instead of being crystallized in a certain very illogical form, which we now maintain. And which, so long as you can afford to hire a typist, doesn't need to bother you. But otherwise, it is a ridiculous nuisance. But in those days, spelling was more or less flexible. So if you find D'Aubigné spelling various names in different ways than we have, like Zwingli, he always spells Zwingham. Zwingli has become more or less established today for that. And John Huss, sometimes you find with one S, sometimes with two. Wycliffe sometimes ends in I-F-F-E, sometimes in two F's, sometimes just in one. And even the W-Y will sometimes be written W-I. Well, John Wycliffe is one of the great Christian leaders of the world's history. He did not have anything like the influence or effectiveness that Luther had, but this is to quite an extent because historical situations were not such as to give him the opportunity Luther had to have a great influence. John Wycliffe we discussed more in detail at the end of the first year of church history, and you had something about John Wycliffe in your first assignment last fall. For the moment, all we say is that John Wycliffe was a real Reformation leader, but one who gradually moved in his thinking, like Luther had. He gradually moved, but as he moved, he wrote and he preached and he affected people. He saw the error of transubstantiation. He saw the wrong of the Mass. He saw the importance of justification by faith alone, and he saw that the Bible is the foundation of Christian life, and therefore made a translation of it into common English. The translation he made from the Vulgate. Hebrew and Greek had not yet come into their own in his day. He made the translation from the Latin, and he had his poor priests, as he called them, go about two by two around England reading the Bible to people wherever they came. And often a knight would go along in armor and stand by to see nobody interfered with them. At first, John Wycliffe was very popular, and many elements of the established church stood with him at first, but as he gradually moved, it reached the point where the church took a solid stand against him. He was put out of Oxford, and he retired to a little town from which he radiated a great influence until his death in 1384. But then at the Council of Constance, 40 years later, he was condemned. It was ordered that his body be dug up and burned and the ashes thrown into the river. And the English, England passed a law they'd never had before for the burning of heretics. And in the next few years, many of Wycliffe's followers were burned at the stake. And so number two, the Lollards, his followers came to be called the Lollards. L-O-L-L-A-R-D-S. I don't know why they called them that. But the Lollards continued up to the time of the Reformation, though there were comparatively few of them then, and they were sufficiently weak that nobody worried a great deal about them. Therefore, they weren't being hunted down when the Reformation began, but there were a few of them scattered here and there in England, followers of John Wycliffe. But his movement had practically died out. Lord Cobham, who had been a close friend of King Henry V before Henry V's accession, was a Lollard and was burned to death over a slow fire for his strong adherence to the faith, even though the king himself begged him to give it up. Yes? No. I mean the result of Luther's works. You see, John Wycliffe died in 1384. And Luther put the theses up in 1517. That's just nearly 150 years later. And despite the burning of many of them at the stake, at that time there were still a few, but those few scattered over England, who were reading Wycliffe's writings and were studying the Bible Wycliffe had translated, and the other people called them Lollards. And if they were to hold big public meetings, they probably would have been seized and burned. But as long as they kept quiet and just talked privately with individuals, they weren't bothering them at that time. They looked on it as something that had been destroyed. But they didn't try, as some countries have, to completely wipe something out as with the law. There still were a few of them around by that time. Number three, we briefly mentioned John Colet, C-O-L-E-T. John Colet, we mentioned him early in the semester. We mentioned how this young Englishman, John Colet, had studied on the continent, and how Pico della Mirandola in Florence, who had been greatly influenced by Savonarola, influenced John Colet to take a great interest in the Bible. And then in England, Erasmus became a close friend of Colet. And it was Colet and Erasmus who went to Canterbury on a pilgrimage. I read you the account of their experiences there. And John Colet was a man who loved the Bible and who put his whole influence in the direction of good things, but he died before the Reformation really got started in England. Perhaps we would forget him if it were not for the great influence he had had on Erasmus 10 years before, which led to Erasmus getting out an edition of the Greek New Testament. And Erasmus wrote wonderful things about the Bible, wonderful interpretations, which influenced Luther and others and had a great influence. Erasmus was ready to stand for truth and righteousness and to expound them most beautifully, so long as he wouldn't suffer for doing it. But the minute it would look as if his pension might be cut down $10 for doing it, he'd immediately back water. But before that began to develop, Erasmus had written things which had a great effect. And Colette's seriousness and Christian influence had affected Erasmus. And it had a certain influence in England, but he died before it could be great. Number four, the influence of Martin Luther. People will say, the English Reformation founded by Henry VIII. That licentious king founded the English Reformation. He's the founder of the Church of England. Why can you have any faith in anything that comes from a wicked man like that? Well, it is not true at all. There's 100 times more reason to call Martin Luther the founder of the Reformation in England than to call Henry VIII. Henry VIII was a figure who enters greatly into the question, will the Reformation be allowed to go forward? Will it be stopped? And his influence was cast sometimes in one direction, sometimes in the other. And the Reformation might have succeeded in England without Henry VIII. It might have, it's hard to say. God used Henry VIII, but Henry VIII was in no sense a founder of the English Reformation, nor of the Church of England. If you want to make a royal figure founder of the Church of England, it would be Queen Elizabeth, not King Henry VIII. But we come to her later. But now, the influence of Martin Luther, we've already mentioned how as early as 1519, Luther's works were being read in England. And in Cambridge, there was a group of students who used to meet once a week, have dinner together in a certain tavern there, and then after dinner, read Martin Luther's works out of the German together and discuss them. And the other students called the tavern Germany, because that's where these students met, and called these students the Germans. And from that group there came men who became great leaders in the English Reformation. And number five, we must mention one of the greatest Christians in the world's history. A man who, with sincere, definite purpose, moved forward to accomplish a great ideal that he had in mind. And eventually his efforts succeeded far beyond what he ever dreamed of. This man was William Tyndale. William Tyndale. His name is spelled in various ways. T-Y-N-D-A-L-E is as good as it. William Tyndale, T-Y-N-D-A-L-E, was a young Englishman trained in Oxford and in Cambridge, who became filled with a desire to make the Bible known. He said, we have the Bible in Latin. We have a few translations in English of different sections of it. They're not particularly good and they're not well known. But he said, the Bible is the foundation of Christian life. And he said, I would like to consecrate my life to making the Bible better known to the boy that runs behind the plow than it is at present to the priest who conducts the service. That was his idea. That was his objective. And William Tyndale, after getting this good education, came down to London, and the Bishop of London was a famous mathematician, a man who was greatly interested in the new learning, one who favored the study of Greek, and Tyndale went to see him, and he said, I have all this training, I'd like to translate the Bible from the Greek and the Hebrew into English, into good English that can be read by everybody and used. And he said, will you give me a place in your household that I can have a support while I am doing this great work? And Cuthbert Tunstall, the Bishop of London, who seemed to be such a progressive thinker and such a man greatly interested in scholarship, saw the danger of having the common person know the Bible. They might even go after the wicked teachings of Martin Luther if they knew the Bible. And so Tunstall not only refused Tyndale, but he sent word to the authorities to watch out for him as a dangerous man of seditious character. And Tyndale soon found that his efforts to work in England were so hampered by constant surveillance by those who were observing to see what he might be doing, that he found it wise to go over to the continent of Europe. And over there in Germany, he found a place where he could be safe, and he translated the New Testament into English. And he studied carefully the question of what kind of English would be the English that would take the thoughts of the Bible and make them clear to the average English person. And Tyndall has written many polemical, controversial tracts which were distributed in England later. But the style of none of these is comparable with the style of his Bible, because he worked on that style to get a real presentation that would be easy to have an influence on people. And he worked on that, and he made a wonderful translation. Yes? Wycliffe translated from the Latin, not from the Greek and Hebrew. The Greek and Hebrew was not yet being studied much in that day. The Latin was first Jerome's translation, which was a very good translation, but it had been copied and recopied so many times that many of the manuscripts were not very accurate. And Wycliffe didn't do a great deal of the translating himself. He translated a fair part of it, but he had some associates who translated. It's a good presentation of the main things of the biblical, of the Bible into English, and it was a great service. But it was not what you'd call a first-rate translation. And, of course, the English language had changed between 1384 when Wycliffe died and 1520 when Tyndall was active. The English language had changed, and when Wycliffe made his translation, printing was unknown. His Bible was never printed in those days. It was merely in manuscript form. People copied it, but they were all handwritten copies. And so a good translation direct from the Greek and Hebrew by a man who would give far more time and thought to that particular thing than Wycliffe was able to give, and who had particular training for that, was a great need. And as a matter of fact, I have heard it said that so excellently did Tyndale translate that when the King James Version was published in 1611, 9 words out of 10 were exactly the words that Tyndale had put in his translation. And when the makers of the Revised Standard Version tried to make out that they were in the direct line of descent from the King James Version, they said they had endeavored to follow the Tyndale King James tradition. In other words, they used the name Tyndale because they recognized the fact that a very great part of the excellence of the King James Version comes from the work of William Tyndale. And so he had a great idea that he wanted to carry out, and he worked on it over there, but by this time, the writings of Luther were being distributed, and the English government had decided we don't want this poison in England. And therefore, Tyndale's translation began to come into England, the authorities gave orders it should not be allowed to come in. And when Tyndale had a sizable edition of his New Testament published, and it came into England, one of the bishops thought, I'll buy these all up so nobody can get a hold of them. So he bought up the whole edition as soon as they arrived. And as one of the Protestants said, he thought he had God by the toe, but he found he actually had the devil by the fist. Because what happened was that the money that he paid for it all got back into Tyndale's hands and enabled him to print a better edition. And then he had to set to work to try to smuggle this edition into England. And of course, many of them were caught, many were burned, but a great many of them got smuggled into England. Now, Tyndale translated the whole New Testament. It's an excellent translation of it. He had difficulty because some of the places where he worked were under the persecuting orders of the emperor. He had to flee at various times, barely getting away, avoiding being captured. He moved from one section to another of Western Germany and the Netherlands, eventually in Belgium, through the treachery of a man who pretended to be his friend. He fell into the hands of Charles V representatives. They put him into a prison where they kept him for a year and a half. Then they took him out there and they publicly executed him by strangling. And when they brought him out, his last words were, "God, open the eyes of the King of England." That was the prayer he called out just before he was killed. Well, John, yes? Was it? I think it was 1913 when a monument was put up to him at that place in Belgium where he had been executed. But see, that was 1536, and it was about 1520 when he went over there. So he had about 16 years of fleeing from place to place to avoid the Inquisition, but at the same time constantly working on his translation and getting printers who would secretly print up the different pages of it and bind it together and then planning how to smuggle it into England. And he translated the whole New Testament, and he had published the whole New Testament and half of the Old Testament before his death. The other half he had finished, but it had not yet been published at his death. Yes? He died in 1536. I didn't remember the exact date he went over to Conan, been about 1520. So William Tyndale is a great Christian worker who had one specific objective, which he carried through with great effort at constant danger of his life, eventually lost his life in connection with the endeavor, but before that time succeeded in doing what has left a very great impression on the world, because the King James Version has been a very great force in the development of Christianity throughout the English-speaking world, and it has been translated into many other languages. Of course, whenever you translate, you lose something, so it's much better to translate direct from the Greek and Hebrew than from any translation, but the fact is that many translations have been made from the King James Version, which is far better than if they'd been made from it. Version. In one way, it's unfortunate that the translation was quite so good, because it was so good that no attempt to substitute something has ever succeeded. And I don't know whether there's anybody who could make as good a translation as Tyndale made, but nobody today understands the language which he used there. And there's word after word in the King James Version, which if I were to say to you, you'd have no idea what it meant. You read it in the King James Version and you guess it from context. And I don't think that's half as important as the fact that so many other words have changed their meaning just a little, or sometimes a great deal. Paul said, "I wanted to come to you, but was let hitherto." Well, of course, the word "let" in those days meant what hindrance means today. Science then meant what philosophy means today. Philosophy, this even 100 years ago, philosophy meant what science means today. The word "hope" today is a slight wish. I hope it won't rain this afternoon. Very slight wish. But in the Bible, it's one of the three graces: faith, hope, and love. Hope in the Bible is a tremendous confidence and assurance that God will fulfill in future that which He's promised. It's altogether different from today's word "hope." So if we can read the Bible and have these words have one meaning, and then when we talk, have a different meaning, that's good. But of course, nobody, since the time of Tyndale that I know of, has had the ability to make as good a translation as that. And yet a translation that was equally true to the Bible, and perhaps 9/10 of it, might say more to people today than his does to people today. If you want to know exactly what the Bible means today, there are two things you can do. One is go to the Greek and Hebrew and study the original, see what it means. A second thing is go to the King James Bible and in connection with that study 100 different writers of those days to determine exactly what words meant at that time. And then when you do, you know exactly what Tyndale thought it meant. But take it by itself, God uses his word, but it can be very misleading on the secondary point. But for 300 years, it was a tremendous blessing to the Christian world, was this translation which Tyndale prepared. And I would say that Tyndale's activities had far more to do with the success of the English Reformation than anything that Henry VIII did. And yet, Henry VIII did affect it in many very vital ways, affected the development. So we will call capital C the activities of Henry VIII. The activities of Henry VIII. Now, in the providence of God, who makes the deeds of wicked men to praise them, in the activities of God in connection with the Reformation in England, the attitude of the various rulers were tremendously important. And therefore, I would like you to learn specific dates for certain important periods in English history in the 16th century. As I've told you, I'm very anxious you know the dates of birth and death of both Calvin and Luther, because this shows you how the things mesh together. If we have to take one area and look it forward, another area. I want you to see how they mesh together. Now, as we look at events in England, I would like you to know the dates of the reigns of the English monarchs during the period from the Reformation on through this century. And so the first of those is Henry VIII, who reigned from 59, the year Calvin was born, to 1547, 1 year after Luther died. 59 to 1547. As you see, it's a long period, 38 years. Yes? Well, it isn't particularly important right here. I could look it up, or you can look it up. But he was quite a young man in 59. He was born somewhere around 1490, but I don't know exactly. He wasn't much over 20, maybe not quite 20 when he came here. But he reigned from 59 to 1547. And during these years, he was a tremendous influence in England. And we'll see why he was a tremendous influence in England. But I want you to note down that his son, Edward VI, became king in 1547. And he was 10 years old when he became king, and he reigned 6 years. So he reigned from 1547 to 1553. Edward VI, 1547 to 1553. And certain things happened of very great importance to the English Reformation as a result of that situation. But then he was succeeded by his older sister, Mary. She's often called Mary, she's sometimes called Mary the First. She's often called Mary Tudor, because Henry belongs to the Tudor family. She is sometimes called Bloody Mary. That's the name that came to be applied to her in England for a long time. Mary reigned from 1553 to 1558. 5 years, and if in the providence of God she had lived 40 years instead of five, England would have been affected exactly as Poland was later. But she lived for 6 years then, and then she was succeeded by her sister Elizabeth, who used to be called simply Elizabeth, but lately some people call her Elizabeth I, to the great disgust of the Scotch people. But Queen Elizabeth reigned from 1558 to 1603. And there's a really long reign. 1558 to 1603. And in the providence of God, that was the political thing used to make the Reformation safe in England, was the fact that Elizabeth lived that long. 1558 to 1603. Now, conditions are very different in each of these periods. We could spend a month on each one of them, and it would be interesting. You'll have to spend only comparatively brief time on them, but I'd like you to know the era so you see how they fit with other things. Now, under this number one, the character of Henry VIII. And I'm going to say just a word not only about his character, but about the situation which made him so important. Why was Henry VIII so important? Well, we've already mentioned the Wars of the Roses. That is, during the previous century, there was a period of about 50 years when two families each claimed to be the legitimate rulers of England.
And for a while the Lancaster family ruled, and for a while the York family, and then for a while the Lancaster, and for a while the York, and their armies fought back and forth across England, and the ordinary person, if he'd support either one of them, might be killed by the other one the next time they gained power. And it was a time of misery for England. And the result was that by this period, the English people were so anxious for an established rule that would not have civil war in the land, that they were willing to put up with most anything for it. And that's one reason why these rulers are so important. That some people say, what fickle people the English were. Edward VI, strong Protestant, the English are all Protestant. Mary Tudor, strong Romanist, the English are all Romans. And then Elizabeth comes in, strong Protestant, they're all Protestant. They make the laws one direction, the other direction, and the people go along with it. Well, no, that's not true. But there's an element of truth in it. And the element of truth is this, that the English people at this period remembered the Wars of the Roses so well that they wanted order. They wanted an established rule, and they were willing to put up with a lot to avoid any possibility of civil war in the land. And so Henry VII, the father of Henry VIII, had put an end to the period of the Wars of the Roses. He himself, having a tenuous connection with the Lancaster group, had married the daughter of the York group, and people felt as if the two were united, and Henry VII had set England on a solid basis. He was not flamboyant like his son. He doesn't get much attention in history, but he established the English government on a solid, sound basis. And so when Henry VIII came in, everybody recognized he was the legitimate king. They wanted to have an established, orderly rule, and Henry VIII had about as complete power as any monarch has ever had in English history. Well, we continue there tomorrow.